This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Jonathan Majors has been acting professionally for just under 5 years. He's done theater, TV, movies, and in that short amount of time, he's become one of the most captivating performers in Hollywood. I mean, look, I'm not really a betting guy, but I would put good money on Majors winning an Academy Award sometime in the next 5 years. On screen, he is charismatic and charming when the role calls for it, and on a dime, he can turn to vulnerable and broken. Watching him, you can easily lose yourself and forget about the other performers. He was in two of my favorite recent movies. In Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, he played David, the son of Paul, played by Delroy Lindo. In The Last Black Man in San Francisco, an absolute masterpiece, he played Mont, best friend to Jimmy.
You see him today? How'd it go?
He said this was a bad idea.
Thought you said he was an idiot.
Nah, he's just mad because he lost the house. But what if we shouldn't be here?
Well, we should be here more. Hmm? Some millionaire? I'd want it because it looks nice.
You're the reason it looks nice, Jim.
Recently, Jonathan Majors earned an Emmy nomination for his work on HBO's Lovecraft Country. That show is based on a book by Matt Ruff. The book and the TV series pull from some of H.P. Lovecraft's most iconic tropes: dark mansions with hidden secrets, huge monsters covered in eyeballs. But it also reckons with Lovecraft's work. H.P. Lovecraft has often been seen as one of the most influential writers of the 20th century, but he also wrote essays, stories, and poems that were unapologetically racist. Lovecraft Country confronts his legacy head on. Jonathan Majors plays Atticus in the show, a young black man traveling across the U.S. in the 1950s to find his missing father. Atticus embarks on the supernatural journey alongside his friend Letitia and his uncle George. There are plenty of moments where Atticus and the rest of the protagonists fight to escape actual literal monsters, but the characters also face very real threats from elsewhere: racist police, burning crosses, lynchings. Let's hear a bit from the show. In this scene, Atticus is on his way to his hometown to start looking for his lost father. Atticus's bus breaks down, leaving him to walk to the next town. An older woman who is also on the bus accompanies him and asks about a book he's reading.
Tell me, what's that book you've been reading about?
The Princess of Mars?
Mm-hmm.
It's about this man named John Carter who goes from being a captain in the Army of Northern Virginia to becoming a martial warlord.
Huh.
Starts with him running from Apaches and hiding in this magical cave, which transports him to the Red Planet. That's when it starts to get good.
Hold on. You said the hero was a Confederate officer.
Ex-Confederate.
He fought for slavery. You don't get to put an X in front of that.
Stories are like people. Love them doesn't make them perfect. You just try and cherish them. Overlook their flaws.
Jonathan Majors, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
My pleasure. My pleasure, brother.
So you've got some vet stories running through your work.
Mm.
The Five Bloods is a story in which you play the son of a vet. The Lovecraft show, you play a vet who's come home. And you grew up partly a military brat.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about what you understood about the military when you were a kid.
Yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, ma'am.
No, ma'am. I mean, it's I guess as a child, as a young boy, it was respect. I mean, that's what it was. It was respect and posture. And then I believe as I began to get older and we moved off the base and got to take in more life, I realized that this military lifestyle or way of being really established a really clear decorum in my life about how to do things in a certain way. You know, you make your bed, you clean the dishes, you say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, you know. And that also came from being, you know, raised in the Methodist and the Baptist church and also just being a Texan. You know, though we were based in California for a while, both my parents are of Texas birth, you know. So, the military had a huge quiet impact on kind of who I became as a man and who I became as an artist and who I believe I'm still becoming, I think.
Was it your dad who was in the service?
Yeah, my father was. My father was in the Air Force. And my maternal grandfather was in the Army. And my paternal grandfather was in the Navy. So we almost got them all. And I was going to be a Marine. I was ready to drop out of... not drop out, I guess. Drop out of Yale my first year and joined the Marines. And so I guess that would have given us the full quatrain for the U.S. Armed Services. But alas, that didn't come to be.
Or maybe not, alas. You're doing all right.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a Marine, though, either. But yeah, we're doing all right.
Yeah, I grew up going to Vets AA meetings with my dad. So when I was 7 or 8 years old, I would like sit in the back and draw and hear really brutal and intense stories about being in the military.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you had any understanding of, I don't know if your father was a combat vet, but if you had any understanding of what it was to be in the service or be in war beyond standing up straight.
My father or me personally?
If you had any understanding of that.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's kind of strange how it comes about. War is a very real thing, you know, and I believe it's always kind of happening around us. And some of us are enlisted in a certain war, and we know it. And some of us are enlisted in a war, and we don't. And though I never, you know, I'm not a veteran. You know, I was never a soldier in any capacity. But being raised by soldiers, and you know, having the life I led, really put me in some what I would call war zones. You know, and not to put too fine of a point on it, but. Being a young kid anywhere is tough. Being a young black kid in the South is tough. Being a young black male in the South is tough. Being a young black male in the South who has a certain build is tough. You know, like you do begin to learn how to war and to protect yourself, both mentally and physically and spiritually. And yeah, you there's a certain amount of bearing that you have to have in order to survive. And yeah, I think I definitely took that on and kind of carry that with me. You know, maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not, but I have it nonetheless.
What did you know about the circumstances of your dad leaving when he left when you were, what was it, like about 8 years old?
Yeah, it's deep, man. You know, as much as, it, you know, it's I'm 31 years old now, almost 32, and you don't know certain things until time. Time has a way of making things clear to you and to one and to me. And in regards to my father, man, it was deep because the first thing, you know, if we're going to talk about it, and I think it's a common thing, you know, it's like the stages of grief. First, you don't believe it, right? If it happens at 8, you know, you don't. You don't really buy into it till about 11. You know what I mean? And then by then it's, you get too much love for, you know, the other parties involved to ask questions. You just hold your bearing and soldier on. Truth be told, it's still a conversation that, you know, in my own personal growth would have to happen, you know, man to man, to hear the why of it. We all know what it was, but what is the why of it? You know, as an artist, that's what I'm most interested in. You know, what we do is, that's neither here nor there. Why are we doing it? That's the character, you know, and that's the thing to really examine for me in continuing to love him and trying to build something with him, you know, after that type of experience. So not much, you know. We've never gotten into it, and it's going to take a big part of me to do that. Hopefully that'll come around sometime.
He was gone throughout your childhood.
Yeah.
Did you know that was real when you were a kid?
Yeah, I think it's deep, man. There's an image I remember. It's almost as if my mother told me, you know, they were, you know, it wasn't working out. It's almost as if I knew the outcome. I knew that I had lost my guy. You know what I mean? And I just went outside and banged on this tree. Just wailed on this tree, man. And I came back in and she said, "Is the tree okay?" And I said, "I don't know, mama," you know, and then probably went into my room and destroyed my room, which was a bad habit of mine when I was a boy. But I don't know, man. That's pretty much all I can say about that on that point, I think. I'm just sitting in it. I haven't thought about it in a beat, you know. Yeah, I haven't thought about it. That moment, that particular moment, you know, the tree and my mom. You play it out, you know. The imagination does that. I mean, that's something I've always been, I've always fallen victim to, you know. Actually, I can't say victim. That's not true. I've always been very close to my imagination. And it's there for a reason. It's like the God particle in us, you know, that allows us to think and create worlds and circumstances outside of our given circumstances, you know, which, you know, helped me, you know, find a path to live and to work and gave me purpose, you know. But in that moment, it really, you know, spooked me, and though time had to go on, you know, certain events had to pass, you know, Christmases had to go by and birthdays had to go by, and to really know, like, yeah, that's it. That happened to you. You know what I mean? Like, that happened to you. And then when you see, you know, you see the fella, you know, 12, 13 years later, you know, it's a different experience. Yeah.
Did you talk to him when he was gone? Did you ever say to your mom, "Can I call him?" Or did he ever call you?
Oh man, it was crazy, man. It was, I wonder, you know, how much of this I should say and how much of it is, you know, I don't mind it though, you know, but no, there was a real effort with kids, man. You know what I mean? Like, there's a real effort to, kids don't really hold malice. You know what I'm saying? That's something we're taught. But yeah, I tried to make contact a lot, you know, a lot, a whole lot. And, you know, it was fated for whatever reason that was to happen. And fight as I did to make it feel better, it was just something I had to swallow, you know, and not just me. I mean, my whole family. I mean, it was, I guess I can speak to it because it is a very developing event, you know, in my life. You can't shake certain things like that. I mean, you want to talk about war. I mean, war with a ghost is something that you can't, I guess some do, but and not even a ghost, with an idea. That's a hard pill to swallow, you know? And you're not equipped for it, you know, at such a young age. And but you do. I mean, we are a strong species, and you know, I think even then I knew I was an artist to a degree, and I knew that. It's funny, when I got to my first drama school, someone said to me, you know, and I'm sure it's a common anecdote, but nothing bad ever happens to an artist. It's all material. And when I, you know, at 18, you know, those circumstances still being what they were, I realized I had a great deal of material to pull from. And lo and behold, and those things, because the material is immaterial, you know, it is imagination in a way. You apply it in different ways. You know, I could apply it to, you know, characters I was playing. I understand and understood at a very young age what it was to be, you know, quote unquote betrayed. I mean, how many, you know, 9-year-olds understand that? You know, how many 18-year-olds understand that? These are things that hopefully one never experiences, but time goes along, and time has a way of giving you gifts, you know, and sometimes they're packaged in pain, but it does benefit you, you know. I really think that's the beauty of being, you know, an artist for me, that, you know, the heartache is inevitable, and you just kind of deal with it and metabolize it and learn from it and use it.
Even more with Jonathan Majors still to come. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from Culturelle. Culturelle wants you to know that an estimated 45 million Americans may have IBS, according to the International Foundation for Gastrointestinal Disorders. Culturelle IBS Complete Support is a medical food for the dietary management of IBS. It's designed to relieve symptoms like abdominal pain, bloating, diarrhea, and constipation in a safe, well-tolerated, once-daily dose. Save 20% with promo code RADIO on culturelle.com.
I'm Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That strange sound you heard on our last show was live people laughing and applauding. Be a part of our next show with real live people on August 26th at Tanglewood. Join us live and you too can finally see what our real live legs look like. Legs. Remember those?
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Jonathan Majors. He's an actor. You might have seen him in Five Bloods or on the Marvel TV show Loki. He's nominated for an Emmy for his role in the HBO horror drama Lovecraft Country, where he played Atticus. You can stream that show in its entirety on HBO Max. Let's get back into our conversation. It must have been pretty intense to work in Five Bloods, which is a movie about a group of African-American Vietnam vets who go back to Vietnam, and you play Delroy Lindo's character's son who goes back with them. It must have been intense to be on this like literal physical journey, right? You're going to a foreign country and you have this guy who is your on-screen and metaphorical dad in Delroy Lindo, who is portraying a soldier, an vet, while you are also... You know, you're a few years into trying to reestablish what your relationship with your biological dad is.
Sure.
That must have been a pretty intense experience to have those two things going on at the same time.
Man, you know, I say this all the time. I think I should just start every interview with it. You know, growth as an artist and growth as a human being are simultaneous. That's an adage that was given to me in school, and I've really held on to it. And when a role like David picks you, you know, in the situation you're in, and you know, we're protected in a way, because not in a way, we're protected, you know, under the guidance and the auteurship of Spike Lee. He's put this whole cast together. There's no other way to go into it you know, we're going into war. I mean, shooting film is very much like going into war. You know, sometimes you feel like you have the higher ground and sometimes you feel like you don't. You know, and it's your crew. It's the film against the elements. That's always a factor. You know, making a movie is a miracle. But the Five Bloods and working with the giant, Delroy, it was a personal experience insofar that what David was going after is something that I understood for myself to be something that I knew I needed and need for myself. Just the relationship between father and son. And what does that look like? Now, look, we've gotten into, look, we were maybe 20 minutes, maybe 15 minutes into this thing. I got to say, man, I had great father figures in my life. You know, nothing can and does replace dad. You know what I mean? In my situation. But I didn't want for any guidance in any way. You know, sometimes I fought against it, but I had a great uncle. I had my grandfathers that were awesome. And I had a hell of a mom. I only bring up those, you know, familial icons because stepping into the Five Bloods, you know, it was like it was like stepping into another family in a way. And Spike still to this day is a guiding light, you know, and a coach and a mentor for me. And Delroy, I mean, we really went after it, you know, because he too has a son, you know, and we're really just in there. I'll speak for David. David's really just in there trying to work out his, you know, and the beauty about good art, not even good art, art in general, is that the artist is always trying to work out their, you know, and here I was in a position where I look across from me and I see this black man, you know, who's calling me son. And all David wants in that film, you know, it's never about the gold for David. And he says it, you know, I say it to David. We say it to Otis, you know, he said, it feels like it's my last time with him, you know, so the stakes are high to get to know the father, to get to know one of your origins. I think that's a very human thing to want and to need. And I know it is for me, you know, to this day, to really get to know where you come from, you know, and from whom you come from. And so David really got to work that out. Now it's his entire mission to see and feel and understand his father's love. That's a deep thing. And that's what the script offered me. And that's really what Spike was gifting me. And Delroy was a great scene partner insofar that it's not all yes, sir, no, sir, when the heat gets hot, you know, especially when the son has been in the world a bit and is trying to find his own footing, trying to find his own place. You push it a little bit, and David does push it a little bit. But it's the push and pull of that, him trying to be his own man, but also trying to find who he is through his father. He has a wonderful experience, and there's a healing in that, very much like Montrose and Atticus. You know, the work has been very rewarding and healing.
Was there anything that you wanted to ask your dad when you reconnected with him?
Yeah, you know, you try it, man. You know, and like, I'm not a therapist. You know what I mean? I don't know how to, you know, and I'm a very sensitive cat. you know, a bit of a crab baby, you know, all those things. But, you know, it's a journey. It's a journey to do that. And I've tried it. Tried it when I was a boy. And then, you know, at damn near 32 years of living, maybe after this conversation, you know, because we've dug it up, I may holler back at him and, you know, and just say, hey, man, what's up? You know, because some of it, and here's the weird part, man. Some of it's understood. Some of it is understood, not necessarily absolved, but understood. And you now stand apart from that individual. You know, you share a last name, and you share blood, and you are a part of a team, a part of a lineage. And just because one is one way doesn't mean you have to be that way. And it's actually you being a different way and being more individual is what buoys the entire legacy. And that runs back to Atticus, the legacy of the Freeman family. We all know what's going on with the Montrose and Atticus situation. You know, there's a lot of, there's a great deal of pain in that. Atticus has not succumbed to it. I mean, he actually goes and goes, he goes to the pain. He goes and gets him. Because ultimately, it's about love. And it's funny, it's a John Mayer song, you know, it says you love who you love. And it's actually about, you know, an amorous companion, you know, but you love who you love, man. And I mean, those guys love their dads, you know. Atticus loves his dad. I would reckon to say that that's an overall truth, unless something, I mean, unless it's not. And if it's not, it's not. You know, you can't change that. But yeah, Atticus runs towards the pain of it. You know, he goes and gets his dad, you know, because love, the love he has for him snuffs it out. You know, and who wouldn't go get, you know, Michael K. Williams? And you know, who wouldn't go find him and bring him?
I don't know if you've ever read it. I think I'm allowed to talk about it. It's been a few years since I brought it up on this show, even though I've probably brought it up five times. But David Mamet wrote this book about acting.
True and False?
Just like, yeah.
Yep, break it down.
So, okay. So like all David Mamet things, there is some entertaining bloviating in it. Like, he's, you know, he says a lot of stuff that it's clear he thinks it would be fun to say.
Yeah.
And he does a great job of it. That's his specialty.
Yeah.
But like, basically the premise of this book is, it's a very entertaining book. The premise of this book is that actor's job is to say the lines loud enough so the audience can hear. And then the secondary premise is theater education and acting education, besides that, is dumb. And I really like this book.
Yeah.
When I was reading it, the thing that occurred to me is that as much as David Mamet is complaining about, you know, whatever, an acting exercise where everybody in the class has to pretend to be a different kind of tree or whatever. Like,
so I don't know why that's so funny. I'm looking at all these trees in front of me, you know, and I'm just thinking about me and my classmates, just like, yep, been there, done that. Yeah.
But one of the things that I think Mamet maybe misses, you know, maybe intentionally,
right,
is that to be the person who is acting, who is saying the words loud enough so that the audience can hear,
mm-hmm,
to be, you know, William H. Macy in one of those,
come on,
Mamet plays.
Come on.
There is a kind of presence and absence of self that spending years in a room full of people pretending to be different kind of trees cultivates, because it's so embarrassing.
Mm.
In a way that it leaves you, you know, outside of performance, right? You have to be present to accept that premise that we're all going to pretend to be trees. You have to be there and just do it. There's not a, mm-hmm, there's not a halfway way after a while to pretend to be trees with 12 other people.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point you just have to be present and say the words loud enough so that the audience can hear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you feel about acting education as a guy who got over 10 years of it.
It's funny you say this, man, because I'm literally having this exact conversation right now. And like right now, like every morning with my pal, we're sitting in the cafe, and he and I have a theater company together, and we're always talking about pedagogy, and he teaches independent of me at a very good school, and I'm always on his about like, yeah, man, but that's you know what I mean, like it's got, you know, like and I will say about Brother Mamet, like, the artist to artist, not man to man, I don't know the cat, but that is the I feel that, and come at me, Mammy, if I'm wrong, you know what I mean? But I do feel that, like, that is a clear perspective of someone who is a master of the craft, right? A complete master of the craft. If he's got a problem with me saying that, I'll give you my address, bro. Come see me. But no, I mean, Mammoth is a master of his craft, a complete master of his craft. And so I understand the sentiment, you know. However, here's my take on should we start with the trees or should we start with theater training in general? theater training is, in my opinion, wow, okay, here it comes, right? So you did say, you know, 10 years of training. Now, I know myself, right? I'm just going to speak for myself. I know myself. And again, this goes to, I guess, the upbringing of being a military brat and also being, you know, growing up in a very disciplinary, being raised by disciplinarians, mother, father, grandparents, etc. It's just a part of it, right? And my just civilian ego of not liking the idea that artists are not, and particularly actors are not, viewed as real professionals in certain circles, right? And predominantly in our country, in the United States of America. There were so many jokes about us, you know, oh, you're a waiter. And then that leads to this conversation with actors of like, oh, I'm not an actor unless I'm like, you know, on a show or doing this or doing that. And I go, okay. My mind went to that place probably when I was about 19. And then it really hit it at 21. At 21, I was in drama school already. And I was finding that I was locked. You know what I mean? I was locked. I was in a place where I could easily hit the target for what it is my teacher was asking me to do, right? That's that discipline, that's that militancy. I could do that. And it's just my opinion, you know, where I was in my craft and in my growing. And then it was late at night, and I was working with my dear friend and classmate, and we were working on Jesus Hop the A-Train, Stephen Allen Gurgis. I don't know if he lives in New York. I don't know if he's from New York. I'm pretty sure he is. But it's about that life. It's about real people. Anyways, I'll make it quick. But it was in that moment we were rehearsing and something unlocked, right? And I went, oh, man. I've told this story before. I went, oh, man, I'm talking to my buddy outside the Pickle Jar, which is where it's like our community area at the school. And it's early in the morning or late at night, however you view it. And I was like, oh, man, you saw that. We all saw it. It was just he and I in the studio. And it was, I couldn't explain what it was, but I see it in other actors all the time. But what it was this freedom, right? It was this untamed response to language, right? Which I think is what Mammoth is talking about. Stand there and say it, right? If you give an untamed creature, right, a task, it will be natural. It will be honest. It will be true. The thing about being an actor is that we train and train and train and train and train, and then we're trained. But we have to train, and it happens for different times, and some people just madly gifted, you know, where it's different. But you want to work until you're untamed, right? And what schools should do is focus on what it is to be untamed and conscientious of what it is you are doing. That is what I hope to strive for in my work, that I am conscious of what it is I am doing. You know, that does leave room for the spirit. We may not even get to that today, but I'm conscious of what it is I'm doing. The training is keeping me on the rails of the thing I've crafted, right? And the craft comes from my imagination, from the imagination of my collaborators. But it is not to speak clearly, though we can as artists, it is not to, you know, absolutely, oh, minute now, absolutely hit the mark, right? Though I can, you know what I mean? You know, like, and that's the collaboration element of it, right? That's like filmmaking, storytelling, you know, when the actor is collaborating with other artists, right? But my take on drama school is, it's more of a take on philosophy and approach. Acting, like everything else, is an approach, right? Otherwise, it's just a skill set. But there is an approach to it. And the approach, I think, in drama schools not at large, is that there's a, you know, they call it the class, you know, classically trained, you know, there's a certain way of doing things. And I'll say to any actors listening, you know, there's a certain way of doing things and you got to get your work done. But you also have to be able to harness that untamed element in yourself, you know, and a school can't give you that, but they should in some ways be moving towards it. Because ultimately we want to see stories about people. And people don't, not every character you play went to drama school. All right. I mean, I don't know. That's a mess, man. But I hope you get what I'm saying. You know, I mean, this is like politics for actors. You know what I mean? Like real politics. And who the f*** am I to talk? I mean, I've got, again, like, unfortunately or fortunately, I mean, I did what I did. And I went to the schools I went to. And I have beef with those schools. You know what I mean? Like, I also have great thanks to those schools. You know, it's like any real relationship, it's bittersweet. I wouldn't take it back, but man, it was not easy.
We'll finish up with Jonathan Majors in just a minute. Stick around. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Discover. Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year automatically, with no limit on how much you can earn. It's amazing because of all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/match. 2021 Nielsen Report. Limitations apply.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them.
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play.
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies.
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with actor Jonathan Majors. He's the Emmy-nominated star of HBO's Lovecraft Country. Let's get back into our conversation. There's this thing that people say about rappers. Like, if you watch, like, a really intense freestyle on, you know, one of these videos of people rapping on Hot 97 or on Sway and Tech or something like that. You know, like that one, there was one that went around like maybe 2 years ago of Black Thought, just bars and bars and bars and bars and bars
Wicked.
And bars that went on for like 10 minutes. And they say he blacked out.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, that is true of many art forms, but I think few as much as acting, where, you know, you have these parameters, right? You have given circumstances, you have a script. You have marks to hit if you're on film.
You have spike marks if you're on the stage. Yeah.
Yeah. You've got blocking, you know, you've got to cross up stage at this certain time, whatever it is, right? You have all of these things that you have to execute. You're doing an accent. You have to get the accent right.
Craft.
Like there's the, you know, you shape your body in a certain way. All of these things are given to you and you just have to be able to accept them all as true in a very pure way and then act like a human being, then just be a human being. And that is like a crazy trick to me that I definitely could never do. Like I never was able to do all that stuff and also get out of my head.
That's deep, man. Because the common day, what we call an actor now, right, is historically, it's the shaman. That's who we are. Like, that's where we come from. Every culture has it. The griot, the shaman, you know, the witch doctor. We have that gene. And there is a sense of trance, there's a sense of elevation, there's a sense of something that does possess the artist to tell the story a certain way, you know, with a certain passion, you know, with a certain vigor. It's a part of it. I mean, I think you got to be a little crazy, you know, to be an actor. I mean, I think everyone's a little crazy in general, but to be an actor is that you are willing to, you know, really come up against your crazy. And sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it's not. But if you're an artist, you don't really have a choice in that, you know, and you just hope that you have the, again, back to the topic we began with, you know, the decorum of a lifestyle that gives you barriers and boundaries, you know, for yourself, that you have the discipline to go there. I say a lot of times to some cats, like, the actor has to be the sanest person in the room, because what they're asking you to do between action and cut is take your soul and throw that across the wall. You know what I mean? Like, chuck it and then pick it back up and do it again. You know what I mean? That's what you're signing up for, you know? That's what you're signing up for. Hopefully you take pleasure in that, and hopefully you understand, one understands the service and the benefit and the gift it is for not just oneself, but for the world as a whole. Yeah.
Well, Jonathan Majors, I'm so grateful to you for taking this time to be on Bullseye. It was nice to get to talk to you.
Oh, man. It was all right. Yeah. Yeah, it was my pleasure, man. My pleasure. And thank you for being an ear in some ways, man. I didn't know I was going to talk about any of that.
Jonathan Majors. He's up for Best Lead Actor in a Drama Series for his part in Lovecraft Country at this year's Emmys. You can also watch Lovecraft Country on HBO Max. Also, I have already mentioned this, but if you haven't seen The Last Black Man in San Francisco, drop what you're doing. Go see it. It is beautiful. Completely unique. Just a wonderful, wonderful film. You can catch it on Prime Video or on Canopy, which you can get for free with your library card in a lot of places. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here at my house, my daughter has created her own set of Mystery Science Theater 3000 robots, including a Ken doll fashioned to look like Jonah Ray, to watch cheesy movies with her. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones, our senior producer, Kevin Ferguson, producer Jesus Ambrosio. Production fellows at Max Fun are Richard Roby and Valerie Moffett. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Thanks to them and to their label Memphis Industries for sharing it. You can keep up with our show on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We post all of our interviews there. And I think that's it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
This message comes from The Run Through with Vogue. Listen as designers, Vogue editors, and industry icons like Erykah Badu and Florence Pugh have in-depth conversations about fashion and culture. New episodes are released each Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.